right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've got a packed show today, so this is going to be quick. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing another segment from Bob Avakian's talk, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. And we'll talk more about that when we get to that point. Now, specifically, what you're going to hear is from the Q&A following that talk, and he answers a question about voting for the Democrats as the lesser evil, and how can people with religious beliefs feel that they can embrace revolution? Two very important questions, and two very, very thoughtful answers. And opening the show up, I'll be talking to Kate Morgan from No More Deaths about an important, powerful, and disturbing report on immigrant deaths in the borderland north of the U.S.-Mexico border. This report calls attention to a significant, albeit underreported, outcome of contemporary U.S. border policing strategy and practice. The disappearance of tens of thousands of migrants and refugees in the expansive wilderness north of the U.S.-Mexico border. This process of disappearance is related to the much more thoroughly researched and reported deaths of thousands of border crossers since the 1994 launch of the U.S. Border Patrol's strategy of prevention through deterrence. These are words found in the opening paragraph of a brand new report that's just been issued called Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. And the report was issued by La Coalición de Derechos Humanos and No More Deaths. All right, and I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Kate Morgan. Kate works with No More Deaths, which was one of the groups, as I said, that participated in coming up with it and developing this whole new report called Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Your report, we're going to jump right into this because we have a lot to talk about. So your report.
Great.
Disappeared: How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Let's give people a broad overview of the report, what it is, and what compelled the two groups that participated in making this report to issue it.
Sure. So No More Deaths, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, started working on this report a couple of years ago while they were operating a missing persons hotline. So in 2015... they're operating a hotline where families of folks who had crossed, who had gone missing, could call to talk to someone about the whereabouts of their family member. In 1 year, they received almost 12,000 calls to the effect of, one of my loved ones has attempted to cross the border. I haven't heard from them. I believe that they have gone missing or they have disappeared. And we started hearing that language so many times, this language of disappearance. We knew that there was already a very strong narrative about the number of people who die while crossing the desert. We know that almost 8,000 people have died in the U.S. borderlands since the late 1990s. But what we hadn't heard very many people talking about was this crisis of disappearance that was happening in the borderlands. And so we decided to come together to write the report called Disappeared: How U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. The report itself focuses on three different tactics that happen in the field that contribute to the crisis of disappearance. The first portion of the report is called Deadly Apprehension Methods, and it focuses on U.S. Border Patrol's practices in remote areas, such as chasing and scattering groups that commonly result in the disorientation and dispersal of individuals into life-threatening terrain in the borderlands. Part two focused on destruction of the interference with humanitarian aid, and it looks at the vandalism and removal of life-preserving humanitarian aid supplies by Border Patrol agents and details law enforcement's routine harassment and interference with humanitarian aid work in the southwest border zone. And part three, which we are working on right now, is going to look at emergency non-response. So the discriminatory lack of emergency responses for undocumented people who initiate a 911 call, and it's either not answered or it is answered very late and results in the disappearance of migrants in the borderlands.
Mm-hmm. Give people a sense of the numbers of people that we're talking about here.
Of the numbers of people who are crossing?
Yes, crossing and the numbers of people who disappear.
Oh, and the number of people who have disappeared. So it's hard to say how many people are disappeared We know, for example, again, that this number of about 8,000 people's remains have been found in the borderlands since the late 1990s. And some experts think that for as many as 10 times that number of people have been disappeared. And so it's really hard to tell because the disappearance is a reference to people whose remains are never found or who are never accounted for in detention facilities. We can't find them in hospitals. They actually just completely go disappeared by the border itself. And so it's really hard for us to give an exact number. But we believe that it is a crisis of thousands and thousands of people.
Mm, boy. You know, one of the thing in terms of, we talk about the numbers of people, but what about who these people are? I really want people to get a sense of the humanity of these people. Like, so who are they? If you can help us out with that, you know, give people a sense of who these people are and what actually compels them to try and cross the border on foot. Because crossing the border on foot has to be something that's pretty daunting when you first think about it. And it's, you know, it does seem to be, or is it? Is this a new development, a newer development in terms of people coming into the country on foot?
Yeah, so this question about who are we seeing cross the border or who are we seeing who has disappeared, I guess I would really encourage listeners to think of who are their neighbors and who are the people who are their coworkers and the people who take their kids to school, because the population of folks who are crossing the border is not a monolith, and it's honestly a lot of people who probably we may never guess that are a part of our lives already. Certainly, we already hear the stories of people who are fleeing violence in Honduras. That's a country that political and economic stability instability rather, can be directly attributed to intervention by the U.S. government and the coup in the late 2000s, well, the 2009. We see people who are fleeing because of gang violence in El Salvador and Guatemala, and we see people who are leaving simply out of poverty. I hear people say, I can't feed myself and my family, and that's why I've decided to make this journey north. We're looking right now, in this current moment, we see the caravan of folks from Central America who have arrived at the Tijuana-San Diego port, and our asylum seekers asking for entrance and being denied. You know, we can see examples of many people who are attempting to cross the border. And I think it's really important for people to remember that the act of crossing a very, very deadly border is a great act of love, actually, that people don't leave their communities and their homelands, their families, without some reason of love either propelling them forward or drawing them to the United States. And so I guess that's from my standpoint, that's sort of the narrative that I want people to be thinking about, is that people are making the most dangerous journey of their life to make it even to this border, and then this border itself is quite deadly, and it's simply just the people who live around us already who are being forced to cross through those borderland regions.
Mm-hmm. One more question before we jump into the report itself. The category of disappeared, and you've used this term a lot, and it's a lot in the literature, the category of people disappearing and just the use of that term disappeared. Why this word?
Yeah, so we very intentionally chose the language of the disappeared, one, to be able to reflect the language that we were hearing in family members who are making the calls to the hotlines, but also to be able to connect it to other movements who have used that language to describe the violence, the state-sanctioned violence of disappearances. So many people might be familiar with that language as it appears in Argentina or Chile, maybe even in Central America. We wanted to connect to these other historical moments that people could easily point to and say, actually, yes, that was the machine of the state was part of this crisis of disappearance, because that's the exact same thing that we see happening on the border, that the U.S. government is creating policies and placing infrastructure and militarizing the border that then leads to the crisis of disappearance. And so to be able to connect the language of this moment to the language of historical moments where that has happened as well felt very important to us.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's jump into the report itself. The report's going to be, as you said, it's going to be released in three parts, but two have already come out. So let's start talking about them a little. The first is deadly apprehension methods. Let's talk about that, daily and deadly policing practices.
Sure. So when we say deadly apprehension methods, we're referring to a number of on-the-ground tactics used by Border Patrol agents themselves. One method that we see a lot of and that we hear a lot of people talk about is called chase and scatter. So chase is the active period of pursuit of Border Patrol agents when they attempt to catch or catch up with individuals or a group in order to apprehend them. And scatter refers to when individuals are separated from their group due to Border Patrol intervention and dispersal into the wilderness. So we see this happen a lot with helicopters when we're in the field, actually. We'll see helicopters that are in pursuit, we believe to be in pursuit of a group, and they will actually come down very close to the earth and scatter a group. What the scattering actually leads to is people dropping their things, running away from the group itself, trying to hide, and also actually in many cases that we've heard of people saying, I ran to hide to attempt to protect myself from the blades of the helicopter or of the weight of the helicopter, because that's how close the helicopters are coming in contact with humans. And so when that happens, normally once the helicopter leaves, because the helicopter does not land to actually act in the apprehension, the helicopter leaves after a while. People then very quickly try and pick up what they have and leave that scene before the helicopter returns. So this results in slower moving people, including young people, or the very old, the sick, the injured, being left behind in the chaos and alone in the backcountry. It means that people are being separated from the person in the group who would be referred to as the guide, who would know where they were going or even know where they were located in the first place. It means likely that they are being separated from resources or other family members in the group. And so this is just one of the tactics that we see and hear about repeatedly that results in people being disappeared into the wilderness of the border. Another thing that we hear a lot about from folks is just the violent nature of Border Patrol agents themselves. So escalated Border Patrol violence during apprehension is how we refer to that. We hear of people being assaulted by Border Patrol agents. One of our previous reports that came out in 2012 called The Culture of Cruelty looked at this phenomena a little bit closer, looked at the actual number of, we interviewed many people, thousands of people actually, and heard their stories of how many times they were punched or kicked or pushed into cactus by Border Patrol or even held in stress positions. People have told us they've had appendages or their feet run over by Border Patrol vehicles. And so this kind of the culture of cruelty then creates sort of a like that is known by people who are crossing the border. And so they attempt to flee and not be caught into the cycle of violence during an interdiction with Border Patrol. They flee, and in that fleeing from the Border Patrol agent are often also injured. And so it's both the known violence of the agent and then the act of fleeing that can create dangerous situations for a person who is then scattered from their group and lost. So part one really looks at these deadly apprehension methods and how they contribute not to apprehensions themselves, not to actually people being apprehended, but that how they are contributing to the disappearance in the wilderness areas of the borderlands.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kate Morgan. And Kate is a representative of No More Deaths, which is one of the groups, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, who produced the report Disappeared, How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Now, just so people can get clear on this, there was something in the report that really struck me very, very sharply. And that's when it, you know,
there's a lot of references to low-intensity war zones. It seems like there is a sort of a low-intensity war being waged against immigrant people trying to come into the country for whatever reason and desperately trying to cross over and going through, being willing to go through all this stuff. But there's actually a war being waged against these people, which I think a lot of people don't understand. They don't really get that this is a low-intensity war going on.
Yeah, and we use that term also just to refer to almost like, it's hard to describe the feeling of the borderlands. It really is something, if you haven't been to the border zone, we really encourage people to come witness what Arizona looks like, because the proliferation of surveillance towers, drones, agents on foot, agents on horseback, agents on ATV, trucks, those things, I think people really think of like, they tend to think of the wall, the physical wall themselves, but the wall is just sort of the aesthetic cover-up for the 100-mile zone that looks like a war zone on the borderlands and feels like a war zone. Like, the tension that is created around this militarization and the military presence of agents on the border is what we're referring to. And again, yes, it is definitely, the reason why that infrastructure and those agents are here is to like manage or control the borderlands, and against this so-called like onslaught of immigrants. But again, this is a border with countries that we actually have very friendly relationships to otherwise in the marketplace, right? Like NAFTA and TPP, the flow of goods over our border and the contracts that we have with corporations, both in Mexico and Central America, are quite friendly. It is when it comes to actually people and humanity in which the borderlands turns into a war zone.
Mm-hmm. But it's also very heavy, because when you look at things like, for instance, the fact that people are, that some of the things that you've already spoken about, where you talk about this thing of like the scattering of people, you know, which is really, when you're talking about people in a desert environment, people in a way, you know, when being scattered is actually a death sentence, you know, it's very difficult to, you know, for people who have no familiarity with the scene out there, where to go, how to survive it, suddenly are scattered and broken away from all the people that were actually with them and left to just wander around in the desert hoping to be able to survive. This is a really, I mean, not just cruel, but it's really an inhumane. It's actually, it's. I would not hesitate to call these kinds of actions as crimes against humanity. You add in that and you look at, you know, scattering. You also look at the, you know, this question of, you know, the way that the physical violence that you've spoken about in terms of what the Border Patrol does to the people that they encounter. If they're not scattering them, if they're not beating the hell out of them, what happens? I mean, this is something I think people need to understand, the ferocity of this and what difference it makes in terms of the robbing the people who are trying to come into the country, robbing them of their humanity, and actually, in many cases, just ending up dead with, you know, it's a deadly direction that things go in. And many people do, in fact, disappear. Many people do die as a result of all this. This is something that I don't think a lot of people really understand, the cruelty involved in this.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as we are talking more about what the terrain is like and how deadly it is and how all of the agents and border enforcement strategies are contributing to the disappearance, I do want to name one particular policy, which is prevention through deterrence. Prevention through deterrence is an official policy of the U.S. government, and it was enacted in 1994, the same time that NAFTA happened. So the same time that we see pieces of the border wall going up is the same time that we know that more commerce is going to be conducted across the U.S.-Mexico border. And during that time, as the wall starts going up in urban areas, the reason is because of prevention through deterrence, the stated logic of which is that if you can make the journey as deadly, as traumatic, as horrible as possible, that people will not attempt to make it. And of course, we know this logic to be very flawed. This goes back to my point before, which is that people have very compelling reasons to leave and make such a long and deadly journey And so prevention through deterrence actually doesn't result in fewer people crossing. It results in more people dying. It results in more people being forced into wilderness terrains where there's very few humans for them to come into contact with if they actually were in trouble and needed help. Very few natural occurring water sources, and temperatures that in Arizona we see, you know, temperatures can be 120 in the summer and it can snow in the winter. So it's a terrain that is very extreme, and it is weaponized essentially by the U.S. government against people who will be crossing the border, resulting in a crisis of death and disappearance.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have just a couple more questions, and one I really want to get into. You can spend all the time you want on this one. The destruction of and interference with humanitarian aid, because there's a lot of people who, and I really admire them, the people who go out into the desert and try to leave containers of water and other things that would actually help people survive if they're out in the desert trying to get across, trying to get into the country and whatnot. And there's actually a willful destruction and interference with the ability of people to actually both distribute that aid, but also of people to actually get access to it. This is actually, you know, when you look at it, this is a homicidal act.
Yeah, so part two of our report does look at the interference and destruction of humanitarian aid. And this is something that we've been trying to shed light on for many years. At first, it was just anecdotally saying, we're putting water out in the desert. People are destroying it either by shooting it, slashing it, stomping it, kicking it, confiscating it. We believe it's Border Patrol, and people saying, what do you mean you think it's, you know, law enforcement? That can't be. Give us proof. So then we moved in like 2011, I guess, we started setting up trail cams at some of the water drop caches that were being vandalized repeatedly. And we actually caught instances of Border Patrol agents kicking our water gallons and confiscating blankets. And that did run, and we took it to Border Patrol, the sector chief at that time. He said that he would look into it. We asked if there were any disciplinary measures taken against those agents later on. They told us the official policy is that they don't release any information on discipline against the agents. Those agents were seen in the field later, so we presume that no discipline was taken against them. And it persisted. The vandalism persisted, and people continued to question whether it was just quote-unquote, you know, a few bad apples, or if it was, as we said, which was that we believed that people were encouraging each other to take these acts against our water drops. And so we said, fine, we'll do a quantitative analysis. We will give you the statistics on it. And we looked at the data that we had on water gallons and where they were left, where they were vandalized, and how frequently. We looked at the study period that we look at ranges from 2012 through 2015, and during that time, we distributed over 31,000 gallon jugs of water to migrant trails in southern Arizona. And what we found was that there was water gallons vandalized a total of 415 times, so on an average, at least two times a week during that study period, and that overall, more than 3,000 gallons of water jugs were vandalized in the approximately 800 square mile desert corridor area that we work in. And when we looked at the land jurisdictions that 800 square mile corridor covers, we found that there's a lot of different actors in a lot of different jurisdictions, you know, BLM land, ranch land, parks and rec land, and the only actor that had the ability to be consistently accessing all of these land jurisdictions year after year after year is Border Patrol. And so along with the statistical analysis, our own eyewitness accounts, and also the trail cams, we encourage people to believe us when we say that U.S. law enforcement is a primary, perhaps not the only, definitely not the only actor, but a primary actor in the destruction of humanitarian aid supplies in this very deadly wilderness corridor. And that's something that's really important to remember, is that the acts of chasing and scattering, forcing people into wilderness area, then chasing and scattering them so that they don't have access to resources, and then eliminating the few resources that they might encounter, yes, it's a deadly act.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question for you. You have, you know, at the end of your report, you have a, basically you spend a lot of time on talking about what is to be done, the list of demands. And I thought it was really important for people to understand this because you frame them in a way that actually, again, intensifies people's understanding of what's happening to people who are trying to, you know, come into this country in order to even to save their own lives or to be able to help save their families back home, whatever. You know, for whatever reason people are coming in, they are being systematically destroyed in one way or another. And you folks have not only done this really important report, but you've also at the end of it, you've stated a list of demands, which I thought it would be important for people to understand or hear a little bit about those demands, what they are, and take it away.
Okay, so one of our demands is simply that there actually is an investigation into agents who are destroying water gallons, and that there is a known disciplinary measure for interacting with agents who are caught interfering with aid. We also ask that we ask for international organizations such as the United Nations to investigate the abuse and the forms of violence that are being used by the U.S. Border Patrol against migrants. We believe that the kind of violence that we're seeing, the death and disappearance, does constitute crimes against humanity, and we want people at an international level to be paying attention to what's happening on the U.S. border. And we also are asking, actually, for reparations for the families of the disappeared and the deceased. We believe that the loss of life that's happening on the border is intentional, and it's being caused by the U.S. government. And we believe that the U.S. government should be accountable for those acts and for the deaths and disappearance of people. And particularly in the case of the disappeared, where people are actually never able to bury a loved one, the reverberations of that trauma, the echo throughout communities and families when a person dies and there's no way to, you know, to like, there's no way for that person's ability. I mean, I hate to like tie someone's life to capital, but many times the people who are crossing are the primary breadwinners in a family. And so their death or their disappearance, not only is it traumatic, but it actually is materially important and materially traumatic as well as psychologically traumatic. And when it is due to U.S. government policies, we believe that those actors, those agencies, should be accountable to the families in the very least in a material way and pay reparations to the families.
Mm-hmm. Now, just one more thing. Just in closing here, you've obviously spent a lot of time, a lot of your heart is into this. You know, I'd really like to, it's an extremely important thing, and I'd really like you to leave people with something, just something from yourself, from your own heart about what is it, what makes you do this, and why is it so damn important for people to wake up and pay attention and put a stop to this horror that's going on?
I think it is, this is what's happening on the U.S. border. You know, someone listening to me speak about it might feel anger or rage or frustration or sadness about what's happening on the border. And I certainly feel those feelings too, but it is being here every day and witnessing the consequences of the border, witnessing the acts of Border Patrol agents and the U.S. government, and being here, it's such a visceral experience. It's an experience that has changed my life, and it's one of those experiences that I felt like once I knew it, I couldn't unknow it. And I don't necessarily like identify with the U.S. government, but I acknowledge that I live in this country, and as a white middle class, college-educated citizen of the United States, I have a lot of privileges that mean that my family and my community is not being impacted by these policies the same way other people's. And I felt like I wanted to be here to use my privileges and to witness and to act in a way in solidarity with people who were experiencing this kind of violence. And that, again, was just, that was something that was drawn out of me from being here on the borderlands and seeing the consequences of what were happening and feeling it so deeply in my heart that I felt like this is where I wanted to stand. This was the place that I wanted to be. And these were communities who I wanted to be in solidarity with.
Mm-hmm. Very, very important. One more thing. I lied. One more thing. Where can people get in touch with the organizations? Where can they get a copy of this report?
Yeah. So if folks want to read more about the report, they should visit the website, thedisappearedreport.org. And there you'll be able to download the report itself and read more of our fact sheets, see some of the materials that we published. You can also follow nomoredeaths.org to find out more information on the organization itself or to get involved as a volunteer.
All right, Kate. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Kate Morgan, who is a representative of the group No More Deaths. And No More Deaths is one of the groups, along with La Coalición de Derechos Humanos, who produced a really compelling, a really important report called Disappeared, How the U.S. Border Enforcement Agencies Are Fueling a Missing Persons Crisis. Folks, this is a time when you really have to pay attention, stand up, and just step out. You know, people have to step out and make their feelings heard about this horror. And I really encourage everyone to read the entire report for themselves. And it will be linked to on my Facebook page, and we'll post it on my website, themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Right, that was Santana with Migra. Before we hear our next segment, I want to offer a further reflection on what Kate Morgan was talking about. The thousands, or as the report we talked about suggests, tens of thousands of deaths on the border and the policies that led to them happened under the Republican and Democratic presidents. But under the Trump-Pence fascist regime, the U.S. has already begun an even more brutal campaign of genocidal ethnic cleansing. First they came for the Muslims, and now they're coming for the immigrants. If we are to defeat even more deadly crimes against humanity, the Trump-Pence regime must be driven out. And that, of course, is the theme of the talk by Bob Avakian, BA. And then the title of Avakian's talk is The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. So here's Bob Avakian with one of the questions that followed the talk.
Fortunately, as a Democrat, it has been a long determined that to vote for the lesser of the two evils, right? Either the Dems or the Republican. But it has gotten to the point where both of them are just as worse. One is cancer and one is HIV. So you don't want to vote for either one of them. And that's what happened. Over 40% of people who could have voted, they didn't vote, or they voted for somebody else, or they vote somebody else in. Now, the problem being is nothing's working, okay? But in the interim, I know the system sucks, but what are you supposed to do in the interim, okay? That's one question. The other one is, as a revolutionary Christian, I acknowledge that the Christian fundamentalists have been around spewing their venom for many hundreds of years, okay? Now, I believe that we do need this revolution, okay? I embrace it. But what I need to hear is, how can you have other people of any type of religious aspect, be it Muslim, Christianity, or whatever the case may be, have it so that they would want to embrace it also and not feel alienated because they are quote-unquote Christians?
Okay, well, let's start with the first question. I mean, the problem, you know, I don't want to sound flippant or silly, but the problem with voting for the lesser evil is, and I don't even like to use the word evil, but let's just take it there. The problem with voting for the lesser evil is that you're voting for evil. See, that's the problem. And but let's get deeper than that, because that could just be you know, just a clever saying that doesn't have much meaning. The problem is you have the system that operates in certain ways, and it's, you know, it's not. I noticed, for example, Charles Blow, who's a columnist who, you know, writes for the New York Times, and he's a commentator sometimes on CNN. He's sort of a middle class black guy, and you know, he wrote this column about how terrible Trump is, but then he turned all of his anger at the end, or a lot of it, toward people who didn't vote, you know, and therefore you're responsible for why Trump is in now. But you see, we have to, let's step back a little bit and look at the larger picture. The reason that Trump is in is not because, you know, or that things have come to this situation, is not because, the cause of it is not that people didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. Because, let's step back a little bit, a lot of people did vote for Obama. And they got Obama, and then why do we get Trump? Because the kinds of things that the system is doing in this country and in the world lead a lot of people on the terms of the system to want to have this kind of fascist solution. And the Hillary Clintons and Barack Obamas of the world did not challenge and cannot challenge the underlying assumptions and the underlying dynamics of the system that push people in that direction, that lead people in that direction. Let me give you an example. A lot, you know, you have people who said that they voted for Obama. Look, I'm not a racist. I voted for Trump, but I'm not a racist because I voted for Obama, not once, but twice. But what were they looking for when they voted for Obama? They were looking for someone who would tell them that this is a post-racial society where there's no longer any discrimination and oppression. And if you want proof, look, we elected a black president. I even voted for him. So now, don't come around and tell me about how there's any oppression going on. If you're not doing well, it's your own fault. And I don't want to hear about the police shooting down people because this is a post-racial society. We voted for Obama. That proves it. So if somebody got shot by the police, they must have been doing something wrong. See, a lot of these white people who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, they wanted Obama to prove that there was no longer any oppression, so nobody should complain about it anymore. And as much as people don't want to talk about this, Obama said the same thing. When Obama got reelected in 2012, in his victory speech on election night, he said, if you work hard and do the right thing in this country, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but this is the essence of what he said. If you work hard and do the right thing in this country, you can be anything you want to be and get ahead. Now, that's a lie. Millions of people's lives prove that's a lie. And what is, stop and think a minute. I pointed this out before. There was a woman in the Trump campaign in Ohio who had to resign from the, think about this, she had to resign from the Trump campaign because she openly said, basically, there's no discrimination in this society. If black people are complaining and they're not doing well, it's their own fault. She had to resign after she said that, but Obama's speech said exactly the same thing. She just said it in nasty terms, and Obama said it in very hopeful terms. But think of the logic. It's the same thing. Listen to Obama's words and think of the meaning and the implication. If you work hard and do the right thing, then you can succeed. What's the logical conclusion? If you are not succeeding, then you are not working hard and doing the right thing, which is exactly the same thing this woman in Ohio said, but Obama said it in hopeful terms. And you know, I could go on and on about Obama, how he's tied in with all, how he, when he came up, talked about himself as a community organizer. What he really did was get involved with all these real estate interests in Chicago that destroyed public housing and, you know, dissipated and dispersed people all over the city. Which, you know, look, I'm not one of these people that believes the line that some people run out in Chicago. It was better when we had a more organized gang structure. The problem now is that all the gang structure is broken down. And so all these crazy youth are running around here with no discipline and no organization. But the fact is that the destruction of the housing projects in Chicago did have the effect of dispersing a lot of people around and actually knocking down a lot of this gang structure. And there is a lot of craziness that's arisen out of it. So I guess I just said, no, I don't actually agree with that. But there is something there. But think about this. Obama is the head of a system. He's not an individual acting on his own. Whatever, you know, first of all, I mean, he's going around now making these multi-thousand-dollar speeches to businessmen in Brazil and all these other places promoting, you know, the globalized capitalism. So that's where he's coming from. You know, but nevertheless, think about it this way. What did Obama say when Freddie Gray was murdered by the police? Yes, he was murdered by the police, and of course they got off. But what did Obama say when the youth said, that's goddamn it, that's enough? And they rose up and burned down a few things. Obama went on TV and called them thugs. So this provides fertile ground then for the kind of thing that's represented by Trump. Because you have this illusion that with this president, Obama, we have now entered into a post-racial society, and nobody should be complaining about being discriminated against and oppressed and murdered by the police and so on. And then when people do righteously rise up against things like police murder, then all these people, you know, and they'll tell you. I remember one woman said, well, I voted for Obama, but when he got up and said that Trayvon Martin could have been his son, that was just too much for me. See, and the only reason Obama said that was because, you know, he recognized and his advisors told him, you are going to lose all credibility among black people and anybody who cares about black people if you don't say something in the face of this. So it is this system that's creating the conditions. You see, what I was getting at in my talk is that this is a system that's had white supremacy woven into it from the very beginning. And there is no alternative that the ruling forces can put up that's going to get rid of white supremacy. Not Hillary Clinton, not Barack Obama, not any Democrat that comes along. Not Bernie Sanders, not anybody. They can't get rid of the white supremacy, they can't get rid of the male supremacy, they can't get rid of the whole exploitative nature of the system itself. And everything that all the exploitation that it depends on all throughout the world, with little children working for, you know, pittances, making a lot of the products that go into cell phones and computers and other things. They can't do away with all that. So therefore, when people, you know, want to cling to their white supremacy, and a Trump comes forward and overtly appeals to that, they're going to go with that, and there's nobody in the ruling circles that's going to really oppose that. You know, Hillary Clinton may talk about, well, these people that support Trump are a basket of deplorables, or whatever she called it. The only thing she said wrong about that, in my opinion, she said half of them. Unfortunately, it's more than half. Not, you know, look, not everybody who voted for Trump is a racist, but every one of them was willing to support a racist, which makes them a racist. Okay? So, and the same, all these things, like the question of women, the subordinate position of women, denying women the right not only to abortion but even birth control, denying them the right to have control of their own bodies in that way. This is something that the, you know, the Christian fascists and the Republican Party in general are, have been pushing aggressively, you know, passing all kinds of repressive laws and state on the state level and so on. And the Democrats will only half-heartedly oppose them. Why? Because to really oppose them, you have to go up against the religious fundamentalism. You have to call into question the whole subordinate position of women in this society and say and point out and say that's what it is and it should go. And it can't go under this system, so there's no Democrat who's really going to do that. You know, and the Democrats are always trying to prove that they're, you know, more patriotic than the at least as patriotic as the Republicans. They support the wars at least as much. Now, I'll get to your question about religion in a second, but, you know, there was, here's another example. There was a case where this guy, Michael Nidau, I think was his name, from California, challenged the Pledge of Allegiance, in particular the phrase, under God, one nation under God. Now, it's interesting, just to take a little more time. That phrase was not originally in the Pledge of Allegiance. It was added in the 1950s under President Eisenhower during the Cold War against the Soviet Union to contrast the religious America with the atheistic communism of the Soviet Union. That's how why we have, it was the anti-communism that injected that under God into the Pledge of Allegiance. And Michael Nidau challenged this, and his challenge went, because his kid was being forced to say this in school. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it's interesting that the head of the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice at that time, Rehnquist, said to Michael Nidau in this Supreme Court hearing, well, there's no, I don't hear, you know, under God, it's not promoting any particular God. And Michael Nidau said, I don't see how you can argue that under God means no God. So obviously God's being promoted here. It's one thing for people to have religious freedom. It's another thing for the state to impose religion on people. And that's what making kids say one nation under God is doing, clearly. And the Supreme Court ruled against this guy, but he had a very good argument. Well, what did the Democratic Party do in the middle of this? A whole bunch of Democratic Party Congress people came out of the steps of Congress and very vociferously repeated the Pledge of Allegiance, emphasizing the phrase under God to prove that they're every bit as religious as the Christian fascists in the Republican Party. So these people are not going to challenge any of the fundamental assumptions of the system. They can't. So when the system goes to work creating conditions that reinforce what leads to a Trump, the Democratic Party is no answer to it. Cannot provide an answer because it's operating on the basis of the same system that's produced this. And so people, you know, go down the road of supporting Democrats like people supported Obama only to find that the dynamics of things lead to a situation where more and more people are supporting a fascist. And it's only by breaking out of that that you can find any solution to it. And so the question, yeah, the system does suck. And the question is, what do? We have to break out of that framework and go up against, you know, this system. At least now we're talking about on the level of driving out the fascist regime that's actually come to power. And I would argue on a more fundamental level, we need to go up against the system to get rid of it altogether as the more fundamental and ultimate solution. So that's one thing. By the way, on religious freedom, there, you know, you notice how they have this whole thing, like there's a case going to the Supreme Court where this baker in somewhere, I think maybe in Colorado or somewhere, is refused to make a cake for a wedding of a gay couple. And he cited religious freedom. It's against my religious principles to do this. Well, then don't have a business, okay? That's the first thing. But, you know, if you want to make cakes for yourself with your own artistry, fine. You know, but if you're in business, that's different. You know, and think about the logic. You know, my religion tells me that I shouldn't have to serve women. It's against my religion. Well, you can justify anything in the name of your religion. You can invent religions to justify things. Going back to Chicago again, there's this like prominent gang leader named Jeff Fort, who was a leader of the Peacestone Nation gang. And he was in and out of jail. And at one time after he came out of a long stint in prison, he got a bright idea. He said, I'm going to change the name of the organization from the Peacestone Nation to the El Rukans. And I'm going to declare myself a Muslim religious leader. And the El Rukans are going to be a religious organization. Guess what? Jeff Fort is spending the rest of his life in a federal prison somewhere. They didn't give a about his religious freedom when it got in the way of what they wanted to do. They didn't care that he claimed, well, it's my religious beliefs that are leading me to do this. So it all depends on what the content of your religious beliefs is. So that gets me to the second question. Look, communists are atheists. We believe that, you know, there is no God, that there is only, you know, the material reality, and that we have to use scientific means to understand and transform that material reality, which is what human beings do when they find a cure for a disease, or they develop some new technological thing, or they discover something like about, you know, the way that the gravity works in the universe, and so on and so forth. So that's the communist position. Now, the question is, what about people who are religious who want to be part of the revolution because they do believe that the whole system has got to go, or that we need to fight against the whole system and that it's got injustice and oppression woven right into it? Well, all such people should join with the communists and others to be part of the revolution. And at the time of the revolution, many people will still have various kinds of religious beliefs who are actively involved in the religion. I mean, in the revolution, excuse me. So there should be, a broad opening to people who have, you know, many different views to be part of the struggle now against the Trump-Pence regime, but also part of the more fundamental revolution. But there also needs to be struggle. Look, preachers come out, and they're not bashful. You know, the preacher, they'll tell you all about God and how they believe in God, and they expect you to listen to them. You know, and okay, I'll listen to them. You know, but I'll also argue with them. And, you know, the same should be done with everybody, including the communists. We're going to put forward what we think, and we're going to argue for it, and you can argue back with us. And we should try to go for the truth of things. Look at what the evidence shows. And many people are going to feel that they need religion for various reasons, you know, all the way through the struggle and into the new society. And, you know, you cannot force people not to believe things. You can. That's why in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, it upholds the right of people to religious belief and to religious practice as long as it doesn't engage in exploitation of other people. But at the same time, we should be struggling about these things. How do we understand the world? What is the actual truth of reality? Can we understand reality? You know, yes, we can. Can we understand everything about it at any given time? No. Can we constantly learn more? Yes. Should we? You know, do we need religion in order to be good people? That's an argument we should have. What role does religion play in the world? I had engaged in a dialogue with Cornel West a few years ago, 2014, which is a very lively and good dialogue about those questions. And we had then and have now very sharp disagreements about the question of religion and you know, different people have different ideas of the God they believe in or what God is and what believing in God is. Cornell says God is love. Well, you know, I would want to, I don't know what that means, to be honest. You know, I mean, I believe in love for things that deserve to be loved, and I believe in hate for things that need to be hated, okay? But you know, these are questions we can discuss, we can debate them, we can unite over many things, and we can struggle while we're uniting. In order, you know, if you want to be a communist, that means being an atheist. If you want to be part of the revolution is broader than just the communists. So you should be part of that, and we should continue to discuss and struggle our different viewpoints and what we're learning as we go forward together. And I think this is a very important thing. We should neither avoid talking about differences we have and avoid struggling with each other, nor should we drive people away needlessly because we have differences. And I think both things are important. And there, you know, look, the world as it is intolerable. As I said, you know, in the title of my talk, you know, a better world is possible. We need to join together to struggle for that, and we need to struggle with each other about what is really necessary to get to that world.
That was Bob Avakian, and I don't hesitate to say this, the most radical revolutionary on the planet and the architect of the new communism. And it was taken from a talk given last autumn, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible." Now, if you want to access the full one-hour talk and the full question and answer period, go to revcom.us, R-E-V as in Victor, C-O-M.us. You can also find it at refusefascism.org. And this brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank Kate Morgan, and remember what she said. Once you know what is happening to other human beings, you can't ignore it or stay silent. You've got to do something. I want to thank the people who worked on my show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Outer National and Todos Somos Ilegales. Talk to you again next week.